Today's cool fact of the day is that your body, if you're average, has enough iron in it to make one small nail, or maybe two staples. That's kind of an interesting thought because it turns out iron overload is a major issue for people. So from a biohacking perspective, having too little iron equals anemia equals weakness. Having too much iron in your blood, as evidenced by high ferritin, is a problem that causes excess oxidation and can actually make you live less long. So like most nutrients, with iron, having the right amount, not too much, not too little, is the right way to go. Dr. Val Brown is an internationally recognized trainer of neurofeedback trainers, and he's taught and consulted widely on personal and organizational transformation. He's got a PhD in clinical psychology, but what makes him really interesting as a guest on the show today is that he's got a background in math, physics, computer programming, philosophy, yoga, meditation, and martial arts. In other words, he's a biohacker. Val brings a presence and precision to his work that's been really impressive to me, and it's one of the reasons that his company's neurofeedback equipment is the stuff that I carry on upgradedself.com. I've also noticed with Val that he has a profound sense of compassion, and he kind of understands energy dynamics in groups and organizations, and he's really interested in learning and transformation. And because of that, he's developed the five-phase model with his wife, Sue, and the period three approach to clinical neurofeedback. These are pretty geeky things for you if you're just coming into the show, but that's all right. He's going to go through that with us today and talk about what neurofeedback is and what the dynamical approach that he's pioneered does for your brain. This is a kind of technology that I use on myself for biohacking on a regular basis, and it's this kind of technology that I use with my bulletproof coaching clients around the globe. So it's pretty important stuff. Dr. Brown, or Val, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. That was an intro kind of from the high-level view, but give me the real sense. When we first met and we first talked on the phone, I mean, you've done some pretty amazing and interesting things. So give me the quick version.
I guess I have. It's funny. I look back over my life and some of the experiences I've had, and I guess it is kind of a unique combination. Yes, I have a background in computer programming, and I've done all the programming for our software. And as you've pointed out, it is a totally unique approach. And my background in martial arts and meditation and yoga and such, it was an important part of all of this, because having that background, I know the kind of place, I know the kind of flow that we want to get to. And I know the idea is that we're really trying to help the central nervous system return to present. So it's been quite an experience over the years to develop the software to realize this vision in conjunction with my wife, Sue. But the vision went back to me in high school is when it first came to me, that sooner or later we'd have enough computing power on hand around the world in homes and just available to anybody almost, to be able to comprehensively dance with the central nervous system and help it to tune itself for optimal flow and function, regardless of why someone wanted to do the training. So I had a lot of experiences meeting different people along the way. I presented for a number of years with Dr. Carl Pribram, who was the developer of the holographic memory model and perception model. And that's really a basic pattern of our software, is that we really see the central nervous system as a whole as a vastly interconnected, massively parallel system, much more like the entire World Wide Web than like a single computer or even a network of computers. But all of that's been simplified in the software, and that's been a guiding principle of my work both when I was practicing as more of a traditional talk therapist, but especially now with the software, with the project with my wife Sue, we really wanted to make this accessible to everybody. So no special training is needed to use the software, no particular background. We have a personal system and a professional system. And it really is sort of the culmination of all of the threads in my past.
That's a great way of explaining it, because I've spent an enormous amount of time. Since about 1998, I've had an EEG machine at home. In fact, if we were on video right now, I could hold up several different amplifiers.
Oh, yes.
My kids knit electrodes into finger puppets. No, not
right.
But we're getting to that point. And the problem is I'm not a certified biofeedback practitioner. And The difficulty is almost always, even if you can scrape together the money and get your hands on some of these systems that are really expensive.
Yes.
You know, like, it's not hard to spend $20,000 on a clinical grade system.
Yes.
And you do that, and then you have no idea what to up-train or down-train, and you can actually do some things that aren't that good to your brain that way.
Well, that's exactly right. And part of the problem is that the rest of the field is still stuck in this hyper-localization, hyper-specialization focus. They keep believing that the way to go is to find the center in the brain responsible for a particular function or dysfunction or problem or whatever, and then what is supposedly the normative range of frequencies and amplitudes and other signatures in that location, and then try to up or down train, as you've said, those specific targets. The problem with that is it fails to recognize that, first off, that when we do surface EEG, we're recording the voltage on the surface of the scalp. The localization effects die away as soon as you start to get out to the scalp, because basically it becomes what in the field is known as volume conduction. We use a two-channel setup. And with the two channels, we not only cover both hemispheres, if you want to think of it that way, but we cover the entire range of frequencies through which any form of useful training can occur. And we do that with a comprehensive targeting approach that modifies and follows the actual electrical activity during the training. So it's very much like dancing with yourself. The central nervous system is getting real-time information in exactly the same way that it perceives. And it's getting it holographically, if you will. It's getting it holistically. You start training some particular frequency up because, you know, beta is supposed to be good for concentration, for instance. Well, that's a really great way to precipitate out headaches, for instance.
I've probably been a little bit remiss in that some people who are connecting with this podcast, maybe for the first time, haven't really got a great grounding in what neurofeedback is and why it's my most important brain hacking technique above things like breathing exercises and meditation and, you know, dual and back training and things like that. As a guy who's spent a long time doing neurofeedback, how do you explain it to someone in an elevator who's never heard of it before? Like, what is your shortest, best description of what the heck you're doing with Zengar?
Well, the first thing I'll say is we train the central nervous system, and it ain't called central for nothing. It's it's central to everything. And what the training does, it's millisecond to millisecond mirroring of the brain to itself. So just like when you look in a mirror at yourself, you don't really have to be taught where to look to recognize yourself or to notice that your hair doesn't look the way you want it to, or, you know, whatever it is. The brain is very similar to that. It's essentially an enormous feedback system or collection of feedback systems. But most of the feedback we get through life is too time delayed to help us. You know, you go to school, you take a class, and if it's in college, you may not know how you're doing until the final exam is graded. Well, that doesn't help you know when to study what exactly. So your efforts can get very misplaced. But with the neurofeedback, the way we do it, the brain is literally seeing what it's doing as it's doing it. And that allows it to course correct far sooner than it would otherwise, waiting for the anxiety, for instance, to expand and take over, or the trauma response to start to reinitiate and then become that lived terror once again.
That is a profound way of looking at it. And it's the reason that yours is the system that I use at home, because of the real-time feedback nature of it. And honestly, because it can be a lot of work to hook electrodes up to your head, as you well know. There's a goopy kind of paste that you need to rinse out of your hair. And I found it, even without a mirror, I can put two electrodes on in about a minute and then a couple ear clips. It's the only practical way I know. Trying to glue four or eight electrodes to your head in a mirror on the back of the head so you can do it, it just becomes a chore. And a lot of the stuff that I've done involves being somewhere. So you have to drive there, get connected, do the thing. And then it requires a lot of money, you know, $100+ a session. And I think you've done something kind of profound by, number one, using your approach to make it simple enough to do the processing and to do just the simple hookup, and then making it so that it's accessible to people for, I think it's about $18 a session when you average it out over the number of sessions you get. So it's in my mind, something that should be in every high school. It should be available at a very reasonable cost to almost anyone on earth. And the only way to do that is to make it easy to hook up and very, very affordable. I think you guys are on the right track there. Is that vision going to happen?
Well, that is the vision. You know, it's a question of how quickly computer prices come down, and of course, Moore's Law is operative there. And so we're able to do things today that when I started actively writing the software back in late 98, I had to project ahead to when we'd really be able to implement all the things that I wanted to do. And we had to do a series of approximations, if you will, as computing capability came online affordably for folks to use. That process is continuing, you know, so is the simplification. I mean, two years ago, we released our version 2.0, which its primary feature was what we called AutoNav. And that allowed the system to completely automatically adjust itself moment to moment to anyone, no matter what. Before that, there was one control that you would adjust at times, depending on how many of the interruptions or feedback events you personally felt comfortable with. And it's been very interesting since we released AutoNav, because for years I was telling people that they were setting the number of feedback events too high, and they just didn't believe it. There's this real gaining mind perspective out there where more is better, work harder, and it gets better. And actually, frequently, it's the opposite way. It's less is more when it's done at the right time.
It would definitely match my experience with this, because I've done, you know, many different forms of neurofeedback. And this is one of the simplest ones, because you really sit there and listen to music. And you know, the music occasionally has a glitch. And it's mostly not conscious. Like, you're not trying to get glitches. You're not trying to avoid glitches. It's the brain optimizing itself because it has a feedback loop it didn't have before. But as far as I can tell, and as far as I understand from our discussions when I was deciding whether I was willing to hook this thing up to my head,
right,
was a bit of due diligence there.
Sure.
And I think that's my understanding of it. But can you talk a little bit more about how the brain optimizes itself when it's given data versus how in some models you control what your brain does, or in the worst case, something else controls what your brain does.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's fascinating to me because the central nervous system is wonderfully designed to do two things. One is detect difference. So when there's a change in the internal or external environment, the central nervous system responds to that. And that's detectable in so many ways. It's an old saw at this point in neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry. But the other thing that it's wonderfully designed to do is to minimize its discomfort. Now, frequently that gets put in terms of it tries to feel better, but actually it's minimizing discomfort. And everything that we consider to be a disorder or a dysregulation is actually discomfortable, but the central nervous system can't detect soon enough the differences that are precipitating that descent into those states. That's why you run into it in life. You know, you run into the consequences of what you do at this moment because the feedback doesn't come until you've had too much to drink and you have the effect. Either you can no longer talk or make sense, or you get the hangover the next day. Well, that doesn't help you at the moment that you're having the drink. You know, is this enough? Is this too much? Is this really what I want to be doing? And that's all true in spades for things like anxiety or depressive thinking or any of those things. They're momentary steps on the way, like the snowball that starts at the top of the hill and just keeps gathering larger and larger mass. Or the avalanche that, you know, just a small event can trip it off. But once it trips and there's no stopping it at that point, it becomes a huge disaster. So our software is set up to use negative feedback, not positive feedback. Everything else out there uses positive feedback. And what that means is there are a set of conditions, say increase beta, decrease theta. That was an old standby for a long time for working with attentional issues. And when beta intensity increases and theta intensity decreases, in those models, there'd be a little ping made, or you know, the bar would go up on the graph. And so you had to attend to that and you had to try to make more pings. You had to try to make the bar go higher. The problem with using positive feedback is that positive feedback inherently has a problem known as overshoot in engineering terms. You never actually just get to that target. You go past it and then sink below it. If you think about, you know, the furnace in your home and you have the thermostat that you set the temperature to, well, the temperature is very, very rarely that exact temperature. Because what happens is when the temperature falls too far below that set point, the furnace comes on and starts heating. By the time it hits that set point where the thermostat is, there's still heat being generated through the furnace and being pumped through the house. So actually the temperature goes higher than that, and then it has to cool back down. The better the furnace and the better the thermostat, the smaller the range of that variability. But there's always variability there. And, you know, if you watch all the science fiction movies, you see the rocket taking off from Earth, and then they're going full tilt to, you know, intersect with the orbiting space station, and they go right to it. Well, if you did that, you'd destroy both vehicles. What actually happens is you go into Earth orbit above the space station that you want to go to, and you slow down the shuttle so it drops down progressively. You're not trying to go to the target, you're almost falling towards it, if I can say it that way. So negative feedback is like what happens in a well-designed sailboat. You know, if you're out in a sailboat and you let go of all the control lines, you let go of the lines that position the sails and you let go of the rudder, what's going to happen in a well-designed sailboat is it's going to point itself up into the wind. Now, that may feel a little bit rocky depending what the current is, but it's actually the safest place to be if you don't know what you're doing. So you negatively go back to that place instead of positively trying to overcorrect. And you find this too when you're driving in winter conditions. You know, one of the reasons people get into skids is because they start to feel something happening and they really massively overcorrect, and that's going to throw you completely out. What you have to do is slowly correct in time, particularly if there's ice, so that you maintain traction, so that you maintain some way of controlling. So our little interrupts, the crackles, or some people call them scratches, are basically subliminal, unless several of them occur very close in time to each other. But the central nervous system detects those, because remember, one of the things it's wonderfully designed to do is to detect difference. So it'll hear that there's something just a little bit off, and that's enough to reorient the central nervous system back to the present and kind of ask itself, metaphorically, if you will, is what I'm doing right now what I really want to be doing?
It's actually kind of profound. I've developed a higher than average sense of awareness of what's going on in my head because of the time I've spent hooked up to these machines. And the first time I used NeuroOptimal, I thought it was really irritating because...
Right.
I mean, I'm listening to this kind of nice, relaxing music and kind of chilling a little bit. And all of a sudden you're just like a scratch in a vinyl record.
Right.
And then it happens again. You're like, bleh. Like, this is not fun at all.
Right.
And when I was done, I'm like, I don't know if I like this at all. And then I did it another time, and it had less of a negative effect. But what was going on there was my nervous system was going, oh, wait, I don't like that. But what it was notifying me of was when my brain was moving from one state to another without my conscious knowledge, which made it easier for me to stick in that state and then to move to another state when I decided to, instead of my brain just kind of flopping around like a fish, not really knowing what's going on.
Yep. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it is interesting because people have very different responses at times. The kind of response that you had is also sometimes shared by those who are highly skilled musicians. And they'll say, you know, something's wrong with your audio equipment here.
Exactly. <You know? laughs>
I say, no, actually, there's nothing wrong with it. That is how it works. But, you know, it's a fascinating thing, too, because what they bring to that task that makes it more difficult for them is, of course, their heavily trained ear to listen to the nuance in the music. And that's great when that's what you're trying to do, maybe because you're a professional musician and you're trying to record something for later distribution. But when you're out living your life, that's not the most efficient use of the central nervous system. To be silently there and not so silently is kind of a critique of how the audio is going all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen strange abilities in musicians as well as cameramen. People who shoot video for a living, they see the world through eyes that are bizarre. They can see through stuff that other people just don't pick up.
Yes.
And so I've noticed through doing neurofeedback, particularly yours, but also any of the ones where you really have to strain to hear the sounds that your brain are making, that they do have an effect on my auditory processing, actually a very beneficial effect, where I become maybe more in charge of what I'm hearing, but also just more aware of it. And driving awareness of what you hear is kind of a cool thing, because you realize, hey, there's something irritating going on right now in the environment. What is it? And you can tune it out or not, but at least you know it's there, versus someone who just sits there and gets, you know, bombarded by a low frequency hum and feels tired at the end of the day and doesn't even know that it was there.
Doesn't know why. Yeah, that's exactly it. In fact, one of our trainers has coined the phrase therapy in the rearview mirror, because what it seems to do for many people is they'll have seamless change occur, and sometimes even forget what brought them in for the training because the change is so seamless. But part of that is because they recognize far, far sooner, even without consciously knowing it, that they're starting to get irritated or they're starting to get anxious or they're starting, you know, whatever the proclivity is that's not particularly useful. And they change the situation or change themselves to decrease it. You know, if you watch how children learn to rollerblade as opposed to how adults do, you see this kind of negative feedback learning process happen all the time. You try to teach an adult how to rollerblade, and they want to figure it out. They want to know consciously how much to do this or how much to do that. You strap them on a kid, and they move around a little bit. They kind of wobble. They play, and then pretty soon they just integrate right to it because they don't get in the way. They don't try to figure it out. They allow their central nervous system to generate and then utilize that internal feedback based on what other kinds of movement skills they're used to. And that's really the fundamental model for the kind of training that goes on in neurooptimal training, as opposed to the other neurofeedback systems, where you do have to try really hard, or you have to notice when the bar goes up, or, you know, whatever it happens to be.
What are some of the effects that people get? I know that our listeners are interested in, you know, sleeping better. They're interested particularly in learning faster, and they're interested in generally performing better cross discipline. So things like athletic performance. What are the domains where neurooptimal style neurofeedback training has the biggest and strongest impact versus areas where it's less impactful?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned sleep, because if you look up in the DSM-5 or the DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is kind of the Bible for what goes wrong as far as psychologists and psychiatrists are concerned, you're hard-pressed to find anything in there that doesn't involve sleep disturbance of some sort. So when sleep starts to improve, everything else starts to improve as well. And, you know, Mom was basically right. You know, most of us need about 8 hours a night. That's really 5 sleep cycles that are about a 90-minute average apiece. Now, there's variability. You know, I'm a little different. For me, it's more like 6.5 works. Some people are need a little bit more. Their sleep cycles are longer. And of course, all of that can change as you age. You know, and your circadian rhythm will shift too. If we really wanted to have teenagers perform well in high school and dovetail with their circadian rhythms, we wouldn't start school until like noon, because it's not for no reason that they have a hard time waking up in the morning. You know, it is part of the set point, and there's some biological, and if you think about it, there's some real benefits in terms of where we came from, because, you know, back in the day, when we were still sort of roaming around, you know, Cro-Magnon time, around Neanderthal Cro-Magnon time, if you think about it, you had to sleep, but there were some pretty heavy predators out there. So who are you going to want to be up awake late at night who can most easily defend the group? Well, it's going to be your teenagers. And it's not for no reason that it's late teens that we draft into armies, because that's part of the, that's just part of where they're at. But when we look at what impact neurooptimal has, one place almost everybody notices to one degree or another is changes in their sleep. And changes means improvement. Frequently, those suffering from depressive situations actually sleep a sleep cycle too many. And so that's the sleep disturbance that they have. And that will shift. They start to normalize their sleep, And it does. It's not about depression versus anxiety or trying to change what we do in order to fix problems. This is the sort of therapy or transformation through the rearview mirror. The changes happen, and frequently the users have to kind of look over their shoulders, if you will, at where they came from to recognize just how much of that change has occurred. Of course, the significant others around them notice and comment frequently. But sleep normalization is one. Increased focus occurs. Ability to shift gears, to be more emotionally and psychologically resilient and flexible. And that also means not putting up with stuff. So if some, we've had many folks who've used this to deal with the after effects of trauma, particularly from abusive relationships. And what they find is that their tolerance for the precursors for those forms of abuse really, really goes down. They get to detect far sooner when things are happening. Instead of putting up with them, they take some kind of action so that that sort of situation doesn't occur. And in many cases, that can mean completely leaving that relationship or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So in terms of particular, like, sports performance, one of the stories that I do tell about it, we also have a little video up on the website about it, but it's about 5, maybe 6 years ago now that I started playing golf. I'm 58 and had never played golf in my life, and Sue and I started playing because we were going into that arena with NeuroOptimal, and then we wanted to know a little bit about the game, and so that, you know, we could have a more meaningful interaction in that environment. But also then I realized it was something that she and I could do together the rest of our lives. And 2 years ago, I got down to a 10 handicap, and the club I belong to recognized me as the most improved player by handicap index. So did I use it specifically for golf? No. But that kind of ability to just return to present and allow my body to do what it was learning to do is what comes out through the NeuroOptimal training.
That's really funny. I find a lot of the biohacking technologies that increase awareness of what's going on in the body really do have an impact on things like golf and
yes,
even like professional athlete level things. But heart rate variability training is another one where you do that, and there's a book about what it does for your golf. So it it sounds almost trivial where we're talking about, you know, upgrading your performance neurologically, and it comes down to, well, where's the proof point? And one of them is, okay, your ability to focus, be in the moment, and then reliably do a complex activity like swinging the club just right to get where you want it to go.
What one of our trainers worked for quite a while and still does, actually, with opera singers, and their performances have vastly improved. We've had folks working with musicians, with professional athletes, I mean, across the range. And what people find is that whatever their level is, they improve because they're more in the game instead of in their head. And, you know, Bobby Jones was the first one to say that the most important 6 inches in golf is the space between your ears, because it really is what goes on inside your head that influences how well you play. Whatever your athletic ability, however, you know, well you've learned some skill about hitting the ball or, you know, course management or whatever.
It's really funny, but I think in every sport, in fact, there's a lot of mixed martial artists including some pro fighters who use, you know, the whole bulletproof lifestyle with the food and the brain activation things.
Yes.
And it's the same thing in that sport. You know, if you lose it when you're grappling, or, you know, when someone comes at you and you switch from the awareness state where you're in charge to, you know, the animal state, it, you know, you need the energy from the animal state, but the control from the other parts of the brain. And I don't think it matters whether you're bowling, golfing, or, you know, swinging as hard as you can at someone else. It's the same 6 inches that matters, the ones between your ears. That's a beautiful quote.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you work with special operations forces, one of the things you find out about them is that their psychophysiological profile is different from most everybody else. And the primary difference is that they're able to return to the moment regardless of what's going on around them. And that's partly a trained skill, but it's also part of the proclivity that they frequently bring into that training, because that's the only way you survive in that kind of environment.
Do you use neurooptimal training with special operations or SWAT team kind of guys?
We've involved ourselves much more at this point with post-traumatic stress disorder situations. So we have an initiative going forward with Veteran Affairs Canada to make use of this, which we've had some just really profound responses with. And I've worked a lot with security forces over the years. For a while, I was involved with the worldwide screening program for unescorted access at nuclear facilities. And those forces, those security forces, are really very interesting to work with. The toughest job in that environment is to be what was called a watcher. That's somebody who sits in a little space for their shift, for two-hour shifts or whatever they do, and then they get a bit of a break, and they just watch a perimeter, watch a section of the fence or whatever. Very difficult to do that because it's very easy to get bored and let yourself wander and not notice things, right? So the ability to just do the job, if I can say it that way, and bring the right resource to do it, not too much, not too little, that's really what the core of NeuroOptimal is all about. And that is about returning to present, regardless of what's going on.
That is a pretty amazing gift if you can learn to do that. And if you learn to do that early in life, it is such a difference, because I know a lot of guys and women who achieve some level of this when they're 40 or 50.
But right.
Man, there's a lot that happens in those first 40 or 50 years to get in there.
Oh, yes.
I'm only 40.
Right.
But I look at the changes that I've had in the last 10 years as a result of this kind of work.
Uh-huh.
And,
yes.
Oh, my God, I feel literally like there's lifetimes of just progress and understanding in my ability to be calm and focused when I'm on stage, or when there's a situation that's, you know, incredibly full of pressure, and just to have it roll off me. And it's that kind of resilience that I'm talking about when I say I feel like I'm bulletproof today. It's not just having energy. Because
right.
If you combine energy with a brain that's flopping all over the place, like, you can sow destruction all over.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you want high energy and high control and high focus. And telling your brain, hey, stupid brain, you just flip-flop from one state to another and you didn't even know you did it. Here's a sign that you're doing it right. For me, this is a really core thing. And for at least 10 years, I've searched for a way to get this accessible so people didn't have to drive into an office and spend $150 per session to get it. Because I've driven to lots of offices and spent $150 and sometimes $250 a session.
Right.
And I'm also really lucky that at times in my life I was wealthy enough that it was just a good investment, even though, you know, I wasn't dealing with a brain injury or something.
Right.
And other times I couldn't afford to do it and I would have liked to. Mm-hmm. So for you to be able to come out with a thing that's this cheap on a per session basis, I want to see like clubs forming, you know, where you get, you know, six people together, and then it becomes very, very cheap compared to traditional doing it in a clinic or something. You just have to arrange to share the machine somewhere.
Well, we have the personal system, which is what you're talking about, and then there's the professional system as well. But frequently, families will buy the personal system. They may have gotten into the neurofeedback because of the phrase is the identified patient, but there's someone who is presenting as the biggest challenge for the family, and might be a child having difficulty in school, for instance, attentional difficulties. And we suggest that really everybody in the family get involved, because everyone can benefit. As one of our trainers says, anyone with a brain can benefit. And I used to joke at times, that may leave out some politicians, but that's okay. But truthfully, to have the whole family working, doing sessions, makes a huge difference. When you have a developmentally delayed child, for instance, it puts enormous demands and stresses on the rest of the family. And regardless of what the particular manifestation of that is, giving the tools internally that are just there through the result of the neurooptimal for the whole family makes it just that much easier for everybody to cope with the very real challenges that may be present. We've had research projects that have dealt with chemo brain, folks who've had cancers, and they've had radiation or chemical therapies, which can really have quite an impact on your cognitive process and other aspects of health as well. But we've shown just really good response in terms of restoration of cognitive function in those situations and in just about every realm.
I never had cancer or chemotherapy, but I did show an SPECT scan. This is a 3D radioactive sugar scan of your brain to look at which parts have metabolic activity and which don't.
Right.
I showed signs, they said, of toxic brain exposure. They didn't really know what the toxin was, but they said they had scalloping and some other problems. In fact, I had two full pages of strange findings.
Right.
The psychiatrist who did the scan said, "Dave, inside your brain is total chaos. I don't know how you're standing here in front of us." and I looked at that as a compliment, you know.
right, exactly. Yeah.
And since then, I've done so much training of the brain, and I am fundamentally convinced that if you have the right nutrition and the lack of stuff getting in your way, like toxins, and you give the brain the awareness that you get from playing this kind of signal back, that the brain on its own will just heal. It's just that the brain's too stupid to heal because it doesn't, it's not even stupid, it's just too blind to heal because it doesn't have any nerves going into it, really. All the nerves are about sensing the environment, but there's the fifth cranial nerve inside the brain. Other than that, it's blind to itself.
Well, so the feedback that the central nervous system has gotten throughout most of evolutionary history is out in life, what happens. So you may not know until you've overexposed to some toxin that it actually is a toxic substance or toxic for you. This happens a lot in allergy and migraine, for instance. Migraine triggers are frequently environmental. Some perfumes or soaps or, you know, a variety of things. Well, it's fascinating to watch in the work. I'm speaking here about Sue also, who was had a massive problem with migraines when she and I first got together. In fact, I was teaching a neurofeedback course, a different system a long time ago, because I've trained on all of them and I've used basically all of them too. But she came and she was going to be the demo for this one point of the course, and I hooked her up and saw her spectral density, and I said to her, "Are you taking any medications?" And she said, "No." And looking at the spectral density, I thought, I guess. Anyway, she came back the next day for the next day of the course. She said, you know, when you asked me yesterday if I was taking any medications, how my mind heard that was, are you taking any extra medications? Because she said, I take massive amounts of medications to manage these migraines. And how she really knew that the neurofeedback back then was really working for her was after something like 5 or 6 weeks of doing sessions, she realized that for the last 2 weeks, she hadn't been carrying any meds with her for prophylaxis or if she had a breakout. It just was no longer an issue for her.
That's pretty profound. If you have migraines or you know someone who does, you know how disruptive they can be. And while that follows my experience with this kind of training where the brain realizes it's having a migraine and then it stops doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's important to realize we're talking here about various things that can be medically or psychologically diagnosed and treated as separate disorders. Our approach is diagnostically agnostic, as I like to say it. It really doesn't matter what comes in. We are not specifically treating conditions. And what we do is not a treatment for any conditions, but we simply have research mostly done by a lot of our users, but also by some others doing completely independent research, showing the outcomes kind of across the range for where neurofeedback has been used with our system with no further modifications. You know, you don't have to do anything special because you're coming because you have migraines versus because you are feeling depressed or anxious or you want to improve your creativity or get back in touch with your artistic self or, you know, spiritual development, whatever.
It's a kind of a new paradigm on the Bulletproof blog where I'm talking much more about performing well because mm-hmm. everyone on earth wants to be healthy. And most people think they're healthy, even if they're not. But also, everyone wants to perform well.
Yes.
And if you push your performance limits, you'll discover whether or not you're healthy. But using
right.
a system like NeuroOptimal, in order to really sort of push your brain's performance limits to figure out what it and thus you can do, it's kind of a new spin on an old game. But if you have a migraine or you have these other problems, yeah, biohack it yourself. Get the data. See what's going on. Experiment. And, yeah, go to the doctor when you need to, but bring the data and the mm-hmm. results of your biohacking with you and say, hey, doctor, no, I already know what my sleep quality is like. I monitored that. You know, mm-hmm. maybe even I know what my brain waves are like because I tried that, mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. But if you have nothing wrong with you and you feel like you're at the top of your game, you are so wrong. You're not at the top of your game. You don't even know the top of your game. And we right. get your brain fueled right, and we get your brain and your central nervous system and even your peripheral nervous system trained right in ways that, you know, maybe Bruce Lee could do it, you know, playing ping pong mm-hmm. by himself for 10,000 hours. But there's much, much faster ways
yes.
in order to achieve levels of performance that are shocking. And I haven't done all that stuff. I'm no Bruce Lee by a long shot. I'm not really a martial artist, but I can tell you how I move and how I think and how I feel. All those things are radically upgraded and so different than what they were before.
Yes.
All right. How many sessions does a healthy or at least reasonably healthy, reasonably performant person without depression or migraines or any of this other stuff, how many does it take for them to notice, oh, look, my creativity is different. My sleep is different. You know, I'm faster. I'm better. I kicked ass on stage or whatever it is they do for a living. Like, is it one session? Is it 10? Like 300 sessions is what comes with the personal trainer. So mm-hmm. how many of those does one person need in order to outperform?
Well, everybody's results are going to be a little bit different. But what I can tell you is that most of our users report that they notice some difference within the first session. That may not be in their identified area of concern or areas of concern, but certainly by five, And then by 10, they're already starting to notice differences there, if not sooner. We used to say that sort of a rule of thumb for most people kind of coming in the sort of situation you're talking about, or with some identified problems beyond they want to perform better, to think about 20 as probably a really good series. But it varies a lot. Some people get to session 10 and say, okay, I'm done. I feel this is good. I'll come back later if I want a booster or whatever. And sometimes that's a really good way to do it, because if you're coming from one of these black holes, if you will, of an abusive situation or whatever, you've got to dig yourself out frequently out in the world from the sequelae of all of that and where you are in your life. And once that happens, more transformation can occur, and you can even go further with the neurofeedback. It's something that you can keep doing really as long as you want.
That's pretty amazing, and that kind of matches my experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this podcast is a learning thing for people, not, you know, an infomercial for NeuroOptimal.
Right.
And, you know, you wrote the code, you invented it, obviously, you know, it's your baby, so it's not ugly.
Well, I certainly feel that way, and so does Sue, and I think most everybody who's associated with the Zengar Institute feels that way, but especially those who've used the product feel that way. And that's the most important thing to me is facilitating personal transformation, because that's where everything else comes from.
One of the risks that I'm frankly really concerned about with some forms of feedback, particularly QEEG, where you try and measure the average brain from a bunch of people, and you say, well, your brain is unaveraged, let's make it average. Great. Mm-hmm. If you're an F student, now you're, well, you know, you're a C student. But if you're an A student, now you're a C student. What's your take on, you know, that style of quantitation of brainwaves, and, you know, the future of that? And does it work? Is it good? Is it bad? And what are the risks of NeuroOptimal versus that?
Well, I think that the biggest problem with the kind of QEG approach and this whole normative data approach is that all of that is based on linear classical statistics, so Gaussian statistics, normative curve. And you've pointed out one aspect, which is who really wants to be normal or average? I mean, if you're in a committed relationship, you know, do you ever go up to your partner and say, okay, can we have an average kiss now? You know, it doesn't make sense. It really just doesn't make sense. Yes, I understand. I remember a number of years ago, one of the statistics I used to talk about to illustrate this was some insurance company, I believe, in the U.S. that had commissioned the study, and they found out that the average American family had 2.3 children. And I used to say, you know, the problem is no American family has 2.3 children. You can't have 0.3 children. You can have two, you can have three, you can have one, but you can't have 2.3. They don't come that way. They're quanta. They come as a single unit, you know? But where are those statistics useful? Well, if you're trying to project out how many seats you need in elementary schools over the next generation or whatever, well, then that is useful. You know, so there's definitely uses for normative data, but the central nervous system, the brain, is a nonlinear dynamical system. It's not a linear system. So trying to capture it in terms of averages or those kind of statistics is just fundamentally off as far as I'm concerned. And I have yet to see any study showing that QEG-driven neurofeedback is better than NeuroOptimal in terms of outcomes and client satisfaction. If anything, our stats as reported by our users and in our user survey and in the research that we've presented at our research conferences and such, shows that our outcomes are better.
That says, that kind of says, in a nutshell, something pretty powerful. So I don't know that I can say the outcomes are better. I've had QEEG-based treatments. I think there was there actually were some problems afterwards. I got some nice benefit, especially on like gastrointestinal stuff. But cognitively, there was a maybe not so positive change afterwards that maybe went away after a while, and maybe I became unaware of it. But I appreciate that perspective.
Well, I mean, we had a number of years ago, one of our users actually helped another user out who had had quite a number of sessions and prior attempts with QEG-driven neurofeedback over the course of many years. She had Lyme disease, and so the chronic fatigue and immune system involvement sorts of sequelae. And she had a history of the cues. Well, she came ultimately to use NeuroOptimal and became not only a client but a user of the system. And after her symptoms basically ameliorated from the NeuroOptimal, she had another QEG done. And the thing that was fascinating was that all of the changes that were supposed to have come from the QEG-driven stuff that didn't come came from NeuroOptimal, even though those sites and those particular frequency targets were never trained directly. It was just what occurred along the way. The brain renormalized itself, and her symptomatology, her problems, her presenting complaints basically dropped away.
Wonderful. That's kind of amazing. We're running out of time, Val. And there's a question that every guest on the show, except one where I forgot, has answered. And that question is, what are the top three things that you've learned in your life, not just from neurofeedback, but from any domain, that you think people should do in order to perform better, in order to basically kick more ass? Like if you just want to live in that state of, of flow and resilience, what are the most important things you have to offer?
The first thing is, I think, the most fundamental in many ways, and that's find out what you love doing and do it. If you really want to flow in what you do, it needs to come from the heart, and that means the core of your being. NeuroOptimal wouldn't have come together except Sue was on board, and all the other people around, and all the life experiences that she and I went through and shared on the way to developing it. But for me, facilitating personal transformation has been that core passion in my life. Everything I've done, as I look back on it, has been oriented towards that. That makes it very easy for me to let other things drop away because they're just not that important. So the related point, the second point of what's important to do is do what you love and let the rest go. That doesn't mean you just completely give it up, but don't put your energies in places that really aren't your heart's desire, because no matter how you do that, at best you're sort of wasting yourself. But you're also going to build up a sense of resentment and anger at having those efforts dribbled away. I think the third thing is vastly connected to both of those, and that's stay connected with a wonderful group of mighty companions, as the phrase goes. Those who, even if they don't share your specific passion, share their passion so that you can learn from them, so that you can dance with them, so that you can stay connected. I mean, all the research shows very, very clearly that those in committed relationships live longer, have better lives in general, better satisfaction of lives, despite even the problems of committed relationships falling apart. But those who have a circle around them of people who are friends and close friends, who they can have time with, gear down with, gear up with, celebrate life. Those all of those work together. There's certainly little practices you can do and all of that, and I know you cover that all over your website and all your materials, so I'm not going to go into any of that. I'm trying to go more for the way I think about what's the most important stuff.
That is exactly the answer that I was looking for, what you think about this stuff, and that's what our listeners want to hear.
Yeah.
So if you're one of the few people who makes it on the show, you've done something unique, and you know, thanks for sharing your sort of life's learnings there, because that's some of the most valuable stuff anyone has to share.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Val, thanks again for being on the show. And you can learn more about NeurOptimal and the specific unit we're talking about, where we carry it, on upgradeitself.com. And Val, if they want to learn more about the Zengar Institute itself, what URL would they go to?
Zengar.com. www.zengar.com will get you there.
Great. Thanks very much. Have an awesome day.
Thanks. You too.